This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate Gee here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Good. How's it going with you?
It's going great. You know, I have to tell the listeners that I did a little bit of procrastination, and tonight we actually get two episodes released all at once rather than every other week. So you get a little bit of a treat, but, you know.
A little bit of a treat, making up for a little bit of
laziness.
Flakiness, but yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
you like that? Yeah. Yeah. No.
All right, so, that's good. So
it's just a cognitive reframe.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's what that is. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, my apologies.
More of them cognitive reframes in my life. Good idea.
Yeah, so my apologies for those who are wondering. It's now the first episode we did with Dr. Hawk a couple weeks ago is up now, and then this one's going to be up very soon as well.
Cool.
So what's new with you guys? What's been new with Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle? How are you guys?
Good. I'm good for small talk. That's it. Good. Jen's building a apocalyptic fort. How's that
that's
going?
That's right. My compound.
Yeah, compound. That's it.
It's good. It's we've had a couple of surprise late frosts, which have been, you know, thwarting my efforts. But yeah, it's that's why you build all kinds of, you know, contingencies and redundancies into your food forest. So I'm all doing all kinds of permaculture, nature culture kind of stuff, and growing some annuals and planting lots of trees and getting more knowledgeable about foraging wild edibles. And it's been very exciting out here.
That's just great. Right.
I spent a good part of today trying to figure out how to get rid of there's this invasive edible called garlic mustard, which is very abundant pretty much everywhere. And we have a ton of it. And it's pretty high naturally in cyanide, like a lot of plant foods are, and you can cook it out by steaming it or boiling it or whatever. But I was trying to figure out other ways if you wanted to dehydrate it or to like make kind of kale chip style chips out of it, or, you know, we have so much. It's like, what else can I do? So I spent a good part of the day learning about how to, you know, off gas cyanide from my wild edibles.
You also might want to learn how to synthesize it from them.
Well, it is an apocalypse compound, yeah. So you know, this is called stacking functions in permaculture.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it might be useful in the guerrilla war that's to come. So,
yeah,
there you go.
Oh, there's a little. So I'm looking out the window at the farm right now, and there's a little bunny rabbit in there's like the golden hour of beautiful sun, and there's just a little bunny rabbit hanging out munching the meadow.
Yeah,
don't get too attached, because if you eat some of that garlic plant, he's not going to be there very long.
He's probably pretty well adapted. No. Actually, one of the things about garlic mustard is it's more abundant in places that have a surplus of white-tailed deer, because the deer don't like it and they eat all the native plants. And so if you have a lot of garlic mustard, that tells you probably have a lot of deer, which we do.
Got
so
it. Yeah.
I think this is fascinating. I'd like to spend an hour talking about it.
Yes.
But
we should move on.
You probably have other topics you'd like to
definitely
discuss.
I just want to know, are you planting potatoes in this in your garden?
Okay. I planted both like legitimate seed potatoes that I ordered from a reputable company, and also some supermarket potatoes, organic potatoes that had gone crazy in the pantry and mm-hmm. started to sprout on me, and I just planted those, and they're actually doing better than the seed potatoes. So, mm-hmm. I have everything covered for, it's supposed to get very cold tonight, so yeah. I'm hoping the potatoes survive. Yeah. They're a little frost sensitive, so. Yeah, but yes, lots of potatoes, lots of sweet potatoes, lots of
all grand.
Other hearty tubers. Doug's like, okay, moving on.
All right,
tired
that's
of the farm
it.
Talk. Yeah.
All right, Nathan, let's find out what's first.
All right, very good. So our first question. Dear doctors, I have been married for 8 years to a man who's a federal government employee. Over 30 years, including time in the Army. He's 58, I'm 50. He's very responsible and reliable, and now since the pandemic, he's been working from home 4 to 5 times per week. I work in healthcare and occasionally have a day off during the week. I've noticed how lazy he actually is. I work out over 4 days per week. I eat a whole food plant-based diet. I do the evening cooking and all the cleaning. I find myself getting so irritated when I'm with him. He is significantly overweight and still growing. He literally sits watching TV or reading articles on the computer and eating crap during working hours. I don't understand why my habits are not more influential. I no longer say anything about his diet or exercise because we've been down that road and did not make a difference. My question is, how can I manage my feelings of frustration and irritability? I border lack of respect and even attraction to him. Am I being too dramatic? I appreciate your feedback. Love you guys.
Well, Jen, it's a cornucopia.
It is. There's a lot in this question.
Yeah.
This is like, sort of a master question of all things esteem dynamics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really representative of, I mean, I have talked to so many people who have the pandemic dynamic of the relationship has put the sort of established equilibrium of that relationship into chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it really reveals how a lot of, all relationships to some degree rely on, this is a big theme in the book that we're writing, the sort of deception that's present there. You're presenting yourself to your partner in a certain light that requires some structural support from your daily life and your work life. And in this case, he was kind of keeping up to some degree, a facade of who he was and how conscientious he was and what his life looked like, because she's not seeing him every day. She's not seeing him, day in, day out without that, intense work pressure that he had. Now he's at home. And so his actual responsibilities have changed, which have, loosened the screws a little bit on how his domestic behavior has now changed, and he's gaining weight, et cetera. But she's also just seen traits and behaviors that were there all along, but he was not revealing to her in the way that he's now sort of compelled to reveal to her because they're face to face on a more ongoing basis. So this is, I have seen this happen in, in one way or another, almost every relationship and everybody that I talk to. It's not always, problematic. Sometimes it reveals things about your partner that you didn't know, but now you appreciate more. But certainly lots and lots of people that I've talked to have discovered things about their partner that they don't love, they don't respect, they don't admire, and that troubles them and that they would like to change. And so I think she's running smack into that. It's a thorny set of problems.
Yeah. The first thing that leaps to mind for me to take a little bit of pressure off is that you shouldn't be doing all this cleaning. You should have a maid. And this is a part of the process of trying to trade as little as possible as you can with your partner. Trade with third parties. So there's he is basically getting you as a free maid is what's happening. And so this is grating on your nervous system, because it's clearly that this part of this trade is not fair. And so we say, hey, listen, we both need to pony up whatever that is for twice a month to have a maid come in. And so that may relieve a lot of your irritation or some amount of it. But I'm completely in concert here with Jen that you've discovered more information, and also because of the essentially environmental pressures on his behavior have changed, we now get a better look across a changing spectrum of forces. In other words, first he had to go to work and show up and do all that sort of thing. And of course, he may be quite reliable and quite responsible to do that, but we probably would witness him at work cutting corners and being lazy too.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We totally would. You just, you didn't have access to that.
Federal government employee.
Yeah.
Yeah, for 30 years. Yeah. Yeah.
So so the point of all this is that that the admiration mechanism the sex and admiration are very importantly correlated. It doesn't have to be, you know, it's not 100% correlation, and it doesn't have to be, it's not all of the marbles that are involved in that exchange, but it is certainly, these are a lot of issues about what we find appealing in a partner have to do with thresholds. So a person needs to meet thresholds across a variety of variables. They have to be tall enough. They have to be muscular enough or curvy enough or thin enough or young enough or old enough or whatever the heck. In other words, your adaptive unconscious is running all kinds of qualifying probabilities, and it's setting little threshold requirements that you don't know what they are. You only can identify it when you see it. In other words, the unconscious calculation then gives rise to feelings, which then give rise to motivate your behavior. But you couldn't have said, well, 69th percentile on conscientiousness is fine, but 79 is too much and 59 is not enough. You could not do that, but you can feel it. And so in this case, as Jen's pointing out, there's been some deception going on. This is a later life marriage. I guess she was 42 at the time, not particularly late, but he was 50. So she's now gotten a better look at who he is, and we're finding a very disturbing admiration reduction. And that admiration reduction may be within tolerance limits if we get a maid, or it may not. And so there's nothing in the cards here that ever says that any relationship has to survive or work or be useful or be worth having, you know, for anything. It's all on the table. And if we were, and all that's going to happen is more information and more accurate information will drive our feelings in a direction that are suspectable, but not knowable. So we can't know how we're going to feel if our partner does X or Y, or whether or not our circumstances change in this or that way. But we can certainly do something about it. So get a maid and let's see what, you know, the next 2 months look like in terms of how it is that you feel. You may be significantly enough, less enough bitter that you are, you know, it's now within tolerable limits again, or it may not be. So that's all. That's the first experiment that we do. But this issue of what we, quote, really think of a person, we don't really have a choice about that. These are automated mechanisms of comparison and contrast and opportunity cost and et cetera. In other words, what we think our life would look like under different circumstances, i.e. if they're not in it, you can't stop yourself from doing that. And you can't, and the only thing that will change it if it's negative is to try to change something about the situation that may make it more positive. That's all we can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think admiration you know, for women really is most of the story, whether, you know, however we want to frame that, but it's admiration for who he is as a person, for his personality traits, for him physically, everything else. And so,
yeah,
I mean, we have to get some of that back mm-hmm. if we're going to rescue this,
yeah.
if it's rescuable. And a lot of this is, you know, so I think the maid could definitely take some of the pressure off with you feeling the building resentment that is chipping away at that admiration. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, you're building a little bit of contempt for his personal habits. Mm-hmm. And you've also lost if I may get a little esoteric mm-hmm. here, the sort of space, the mysterious space in a relationship where desire exists. So this is language that, you know, comes from people like Esther Perel, and lots of people talk this way, but you know, familiarity breeds contempt. There's not enough of him that you're discovering and seeing in a new light on an ongoing basis to drive a kind of consistent repeat exposure effect to drive admiration. And so instead you're seeing this sort of laziness and this he'd rather spend time, you know, watching TV or reading his articles than spending time with you. And so this is similar to a question that we had, you know, I think on our Living Wisdom Q&A that we do with our members on our website, where a woman's partner is spending all of his time playing yes. video games. And it's like, okay, well, let's run an experiment where we do a date night. Because if you introduce something like a date night, you are getting him out of this rut. You're seeing him in that light where he is back in, you know, really kind of a deception mode, back in the courtship mode of trying to show himself off in the best possible light that he can to engender your attraction to him. And you're building back in that little, that mysterious space and driving that desire effect. So, and if he doesn't want to do a date night, that gives you a lot of information in itself about how he values you and where he is in this relationship. So that's another, in addition to the maid experiment, I would say, you know, going at this in a very open way and saying, I feel like in the pandemic, we've kind of slipped into a rut and, you know, we should try to take each other out once a week or a couple times a month and just get out of here and go enjoy each other and, you know, go experience new things together. I think that's important for the health of our relationship. And see how he responds to that and see how that affects your nervous system, because that alone might help drive some of his own innate motivation to improve himself and might help you feel a little bit of that lost admiration for him.
Wonderful.
Excellent. Great.
So Dr. Hawk, I'm just want to, you know, make sure. So you're essentially saying that, that the pandemic more revealed certain personality characteristics rather than created a situation where people are just, you know, locked in their house, they're eating a bunch of stuff that they would normally eat, but that's just all they can do. So that doesn't necessarily cause this. This was just revealed it. Did I understand that right?
Right.
Yeah. It pulled it out of their personality repertoire. So it was in there. And this is why we talk so often about personality being an expression of genes in the context of environmental incentives and constraints. So the personality that you're expressing at any given time, your level of conscientiousness is very different if you've got a micromanaging boss breathing down your neck, demanding a report on time versus, you're working at a Subway in a mall and nobody ever comes in and you can kind of do whatever you want. And oh, well, when somebody or when the boss comes in or when the district manager comes in, suddenly you're conscientious again. So those levels of conscientiousness are in that organism waiting to be made salient by the environmental pressures. It's not like the pandemic has transformed anybody into a different person. It has just elicited different personality expressions because it's a different environmental context.
Yeah, and thereby you got a better look at it. So
yeah,
it's effectively
you're actually getting to know him more fully.
Right. Yeah, it's like you're essentially what you're doing is you're running an experiment on him. We're putting him in situation A, then we're putting him in situation B. And so, and that's exactly what transpired here. And what she's finding out is things that he's slipping below thresholds on her estimation of what this personality really is. And this thing's in trouble. So, yeah, we take everything Jen is saying to heart and we hope for the best. That's what we can do. Wow.
Thank you so much. Really.
All right.
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, I appreciate your work and knowledge, and I'm in a bit of a dilemma. I'm in a relationship for about 4 years now. I'm an agreeable introvert. She is a disagreeable introvert. Sorry. We both like spending time together and doing things together, but our sex life is not great. She has some medical reasons and penetration is painful. And this is something that comes up every now and then. She confessed that previous relationships ended because of this. I can feel that most times she's not enjoying having sex, but she puts up with it. My question is such a dynamic possible? Can a relationship survive long term? My sex drive is quite high. I'm 30 years old. She's 28. I feel like we should make it work, but don't know what are the odds of this. And I find myself reaching out to different outlets to express my needs.
Well, Jen, where do you want to start?
Yeah. I think this is a more common issue than people think, you know? Mm-hmm. I think you and I have both known people who have had success with this therapeutically, mm-hmm. sort of talking it through, even in kind of a psychodynamic context, like, oh, you know, you're holding on to past bad experiences and we need to let them go. and you know, all kinds of different approaches. And so he's hinting at this case. In this case, there are some medical reasons, but I would suspect that it's at least in part, there's also some psychology around here to be unwound with a competent therapist who can kind of work with her and talk her through these things and do obviously not the kind of exposure therapy that we usually talk about when we talk about exposure therapy, but sort of getting her more comfortable with the idea.
Yeah. We don't know what these medical issues are and what the nature of it is that she's running into. And so we have to start at different points of our assumption about what is actually going on. Do we have a situation where there's a high sexual attraction on both parties and that she would be very interested, but she has a vaginismus type thing or whatever you call this, that this is very difficult for her? Is that what's going on? Or is it that she's not that into it generally? Or is it she not that into it generally because it's so often painful? These are like super interesting questions that go to the heart of whether or not this relationship is something that is worth investing in, or whether or not what we really have is a dead relationship and a relatively unmotivated female in the sex department because she's not that into it. So hard to know, and I don't know what the answer is. But
I guess I'm assuming that it's not a question of not being into it because it sounds like this has been consistent since the beginning. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm just making that assumption from the question. But it's that would be a really important thing to know. Like if it used to be great, mm-hmm. and you know there was no issue, and now we have this issue and this avoidance, then it totally could be a cover story, and you know a deeply subjectively believed cover story on her part. That is just an avoidance mechanism.
Who knows? But I'm more likely to think that it could be, the causality could look like this, that she could have some essentially, conditioned or appropriately not conditioned muscular, you know, reflexes in that area. And the it turns out there's you know, hippy-dippy people in this arena that know how to help that problem, if that is her problem. And so I know of one in Sonoma County who is outstanding at doing exactly this kind of thing. She's a LPC or some kind of a therapist, but this is really what she is. And so this is not the same thing as a sex therapist who gets a couple together to talk about how to focus and look in each other's eyes and all this jazz. No, we're talking about, a series of penetrating, devices that you use and then get knowledgeable about use of lubrications, and that you essentially get the woman more increasingly comfortable with that penetration, to the point where she's not getting these essentially reflex spasms. Okay, so that could be doable, and if that winds up, so that individual, complete probably with nose ring or tattoos, needs to be found. And there's probably, if you're in any big city, such an individual exists. And
that's who I'm talking about with the and there's this, yeah. Often comes bundled with psychodynamic stuff,
right? Which is not, I wouldn't have thought of that. Yeah.
So it's sort of like, well, let's talk through your whole, like, why are you having this issue? And now let's guide you through this, very, very gradual process. At the same time, we're unwinding all of your emotions associated with it. So there may be that kind of, it's, unless you live in a really big city where you can really have your choice of practitioners, you're probably not going to find somebody who's evolutionarily minded on this question. So you're just going to have to roll with a psychodynamic approach.
I wasn't actually understanding where you're coming from, Jen. Now I understand. No, we can't get what we need without taking a bunch of stuff we don't want.
Exactly. Yeah.
You can take my car, but you got to take all the crap that's in it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's got it. But knowing that's what we're trying to get accomplished. We're trying to get to the knowledge base and the exercise process. It's probably online, but it might be better off face-to-face with someone who knows a lot of detail and can ask all the detailed questions. This is basically an engineering problem, and we need somebody that is wise enough to help a person through this. Now, then we're going to run into, hey, if she's not motivated, that's an interesting little mark on the score sheet. Okay, so if a relationship, and people differ also dramatically in how important sexuality is to their existence. And so, there are people for whom it is a very low priority. And so, and that may be true for this person, and this difficulty just simply has accentuated it and made it more so. So we don't know. There's too many unknowns, but one thing I know is that if we have an identifiable problem and we have a possible or significantly possible solution, we have to go for that first, because we don't know what else we have until we have made that effort. So I think it's unlikely that efforts in this direction wouldn't be rewarded with some degree of improvement. It's slightly puzzling and actually very promising that it's not, quote, always a problem. It's intermittent. That's important. These are important, little data points. So these are young people, and no matter how cool and slick they are, there may be an awful lot about human sexuality that because of these issues, they need some very knowledgeable guidance about this. So we go that direction, and we see what we can get. And if the person's a dud all the way around, throw them back. You're only 30. I wasn't going to say that, Jen. I wasn't going to say it. And then it just came out.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's a little different situation than if you're 48 and you've got four kids. You know what I mean? Let's be smart about this. So do the very best you can. And if sexuality is very important to this young man, for God's sakes, if this thing cannot be resolved with some significant effort, then take a long, hard look at this, because life is long. We don't want to be frustrated and miserable in that area of your life. Unless we're under a leftist regime somewhere, then you. And your choices are limited. All right, let's move on.
I think we got to replace Dr. Hawk's toxic masculinity alarm with the communist alarm. So,
very good point.
That would be.
All right.
Well, yes. Just play the Soviet anthem.
All right. Our next question.
Yeah.
All right. Dear doctors, how can I tell if my boyfriend is in love with or is really interested in his female friend? For some context, he's not confident around women and wouldn't really make an overt first move. But this friend asked him to help her get an internship or job, and he said he'd ask his sister, who's high up at a tech company. There have been other signs that they're too convoluted and long to explain for this particular question. But the question is, how often would you say intuition is right in these situations?
Well, there's not a ton of information here, but it's ominous. Let me put it that way.
It's ominous.
Yeah.
It's ominous.
Go ahead. What are some things you're seeing, Jen?
I mean, I would say female intuition is just a correlation machine. Mm-hmm. And you have a feeling, even if you can't quite articulate it, of how much of an outlier this behavior is relative to his other behavior around other women. We need to know a lot of things. We need to know, like, you know, have you been really had this reaction before? How long have you been together? How much data are you working with? And in terms of, you know, have you seen him interact with other attractive female friends and not behave this way? But I suspect if alarms are going off, you know, there's something about this that is it's striking your nervous system as sufficiently unusual to warrant more investigation. You know, these are what he's doing here. I mean, telling her that he'll talk to his sister in itself is not a huge issue, but it's context dependent. You know, if normally he would not raise a finger to help even a very attractive female, and you've watched that happen dozens of times, but this time it's happening, then it's going to ping your radar. You're going to say, what's going on here? I need to know more. And you're mentioning other signs and it's convoluted. That sounds to me like an accumulation of information over time that is starting to map up on a regression line, and basically telling you I'm seeing something here. I can't prove it, but it just doesn't feel right. And so female intuition is, you know, pretty good if we look at it through that lens, although with the caveat that, you know, it's subject to personality distortion like everything else is. And so if you're a highly jealous, possessive person in general, and, you know, anybody that he, you know, you get jealous of the way that he talks to the waitress at the restaurant, which, you know, happens. I've seen this happen. And, you know, really any attention to any other female apart from yourself is going to raise this kind of alarm. Then you need to kind of control for that distortion. But if you're not, and this is genuinely unusual relative to how he interacts with other women, then, you know, it's worrisome.
I remember Dr. Lyle or Dr. Hawk, maybe a couple of years ago on one of the podcasts, you mentioned maybe it was David Buss, or he had some data that said that when a partner suspects their partner of, you know, stepping out or, you know, maybe thinking of stepping out, their intuition is almost always right.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jen I had to stop and write down what you said, Jen. Female intuition is a correlation machine. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's what
well, all intuition is,
sure.
But yeah.
That's what the adaptive unconscious is, actually, is a correlation machine. And so, so David Buss, he either reported, he may have done the research, I can't remember. He may just be reporting on the research somewhere in one of his books. And I think it is I think it's in the New Science of the Mind, but it might have been in something else. But might have been in Evolution of Desire or Why Women Have Sex or something. But at any rate, the results were striking, and that is that in every case that one partner was suspecting the other partner, actually this wasn't being in love with somebody; it was of having an affair. And so the answer, the truth was, behind closed doors, it was admitted that they were either, the other party was either having an affair or was very seriously considering it. So there was not an exception where somebody was just flat out wrong. So that is super interesting. And that is, that means that, that as this person is leaking, that there's a lot of little cues that are going on here. As Jen is saying, the dots are formulating around a line, and you know, that doesn't mean that your relationship is totally doomed. It means that there may be some attractive hussy who is essentially finding a way to use her charms to get your boyfriend to do stuff for her that are you know, is good for. This is sort of like watching Scarlett O'Hara, you know, maneuver people around and go out and get killed. Okay, so the it doesn't mean that your relationship is doomed, but it is certainly insulting to watch what it is that you're seeing. And it certainly, it doesn't bode well for the esteem signals that you are receiving from him. So, you know, doesn't look good. And the one thing about these things is that time always tells the tale. That I always tell people when they are in an early relationship and they're bouncing off the walls, I'll tell them, you're going to know a lot more in 30 days. And 30 days is like an eternity, because they really have a great deal of anxiety and angst about whether this great possible thing is actually going to hell, or whether or not it's going to survive. And what about this? Is this a pathognomonic sign that means we're doomed? Or what do you think? He said this, or she said that, or did this, or did that. It's like I tell them, hey, listen, we can't figure it out. We'll know an awful lot more in 30 days. And if you're past the 30-day deal and you have a more established relationship, but you're still... it's hazy and confused, and you're not sure where you are, and you're 4 or 5 months in, and you know, or 6 months in, and it's like, well, guess what? You'll know an awful lot more in 90 days. So you may not know a lot more in 30 days, but you'll know an awful lot more in 90 days. So this is just, as Jen says, these are putting dots on a graph, and sooner or later, the truth will be evident. And there's nothing we can do to change that. All you can do is keep your eyes open. And your intuition will be on, and it will lead you down to where, you know, it'll let you know as soon as the evidence is sufficiently, you know, compelling.
But even, I suppose that's, if the question is he interested in her? Your intuition may get very clear on that question, but as you're saying, that doesn't mean he's ever going to do anything about it.
Right.
I mean, if he is, you know, not a first mover, it depends if we're dealing with Scarlett O'Hara or not.
Yeah.
And even then it depends on, you know, his all kinds of his personality characteristics and the nature of his pair bondedness and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think sometimes women in relationships with guys like this, who are the sort of more of the beta males, who are not giving not the pursuers, not the aggressors. They're not always great about sending good relationship signals once they're in the relationship, because as the female, you probably, you know, moved in similar ways that this female is ensnaring him with her wiles, if that is what's going on. So you might see some of that in, you know, of yourself in that, and that's causing you some angst. And these are, you know, sometimes these are not guys that are great once they're in a pair bond at making you feel really secure in the pair bond, because you were the aggressor. And the signals are just kind of all scrambled in that way. So that can be a little bit of a tough thing when you're seeing him give what look like positive signals to another female, and you're not getting them, and you're feeling insecure in the pair bond. And so that, you know, it makes sense that it's going to be sending little alarm bells off all over the place. But as Doug says, there's really not much to do here except wait it out. And you're certainly not going to advantage the situation by interrogating him or, you know, making a huge issue of it. I would say just waiting for more data and seeing what happens. But just because he's got a flirtation and some interest in someone else is not cause for, it's not a catastrophe in itself.
Fantastic. I keep thinking Yeah. I keep thinking, it's like, well, Dr. Lau, we've been together for a year. What should we do? And you say, well, we'll know a lot more in 90 days.
Yeah.
It just keeps recurring.
And well, the truth is that if you're under a lot of uncertainty over a substantial amount of time, we know that there's a dicey cost benefit that's being, that, in other words, the cost benefit analysis is not clear, which, by the way, is not good. Okay. The cost benefit analysis, if it's strongly good, it will send you very strong signals very consistently, and only rarely give you pause to, you know, basically some occasional indigestion under periodic conflicts that will come up. But we shouldn't be in that state often. And if we're in that state a lot a year in, quite frankly, almost always you're in the wrong place. That doesn't mean that an awful lot of people don't get married and have kids and tough out, you know, basically a so-so married life, but, you know, with a decent human at the end of that. But this is not a tragedy. This is just simply the score, the emotional scorecard that your life had as a result of that relationship that it calculated it all out. And for whatever reason, it made the decision that it was done. You know, it didn't want to risk the cold blue ocean. And so as a result, it went ahead along with this thing, whatever it was, that had all kinds of evidence that it was so-so. Okay. And then they come into marriage therapy 8 years later, like, gee, you know, we really want to fix our relationship, blah, blah, blah. It's like, whatever. This relationship is emerging precisely as all the dots were already on the graph. You know, I mean, this isn't always true, but this is a very common pattern. And so, as Jen said, it's a correlation machine. And so, you know, a year in, you've got a hell of a lot of dots on a graph. Tremendous amount of dots on a graph. So there will be an emotional tone that will emerge quite consistently, and there'll be a mean emotional tone that if we were to compile all those dots and then run a mean analysis on it, we can tell. How good is it? Is it very good? Is it pretty good? Is it so-so, or is it mediocre, or is it terrible? If it's terrible, we're going to get out of there, okay? If it's mediocre, depends on our risk tolerance, depends on, you know, how open we are, depends on our perceived probability of success elsewhere, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing that we're not going to do is we're probably not going to do anything to change it. Okay, the relationships for almost all intents and purposes, that not that there aren't occasional structural change or things that need to be negotiated and can be that will actually improve relationships in some ways. It is sometimes possible to improve relationship by working through some conflicts. That is true, but it is not particularly typically true. So what's typically true is, you know, what you have at the end of a year is a graph, and that thing either looks like, you know, there's a slope on that graph. And that slope is foretelling your future. That's a fortune teller. And so pay attention.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk. You want to do one more question?
What do we got?
We got the one about the...
Yeah, we got one more. Go ahead.
One more?
Roll it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, our last question. Dear doctors, is it possible to be an agreeable, highly testosteronized male? What would such a male look like? This confuses me because I often think of a highly testosteronized male as a dominance, climbing, aggressive, and overly competitive. So I'm wondering how these traits could coexist.
Yeah. It's not so simple that one little chemical is the story of, in other words, testosterone levels are correlated with how disagreeable you are, but they are not the only thing. Okay, so the system is not that simple. So you will occasionally find highly testosteronized individuals that are very pleasant. Okay, so so the answer to the question is, it is not a simple one-to-one relationship at all, and therefore all kinds of combinations are on the table. So you could have a low testosteronized person that would be very disagreeable. Okay, so the
the fact that you can easily imagine that character is the thought experiment you need, because it's a little harder to imagine the high testosterone.
Right. Maybe they're upset because they have low testosterone, you know.
But yeah, there's lots of low testosterone disagreeable. So you can clearly envision that. That is not somebody you'd want to be assigned to on a group project at school.
Yeah, a great example. I mean, there would be many examples that I could pull out of the sports world.
I was thinking of the sports world, and then I was like, no, there's got to be something that's not in the sports world.
Sorry about that, Jen.
I was trying to think of,
It's just searching my database, okay? And so I just watched for probably the fifth time the fabulous docuseries, The Last Dance. If you have a single sports neuron in you, I would recommend to anybody that they watch this. It's the story of Michael Jordan and the Bulls, and it's an incredible series. And one of the things that you find out in there is that Michael Jordan is disagreeable as hell. Okay, and he's very funny and can be extremely personable, but he is ultimately very disagreeable. And you also find out that he had a teammate named Scotty Burrell, who, just as big as Michael, just as strong as Michael, you know, obviously very competitive guy, he's a professional athlete, he's world champion, and he's unbelievably nice. And it irritates Jordan the whole time. He's just picking on him, pushing him, trying to get him to be ready for when the fight breaks out between them and the Knicks, that, you know, Scotty's going to be ready for it. And Burrell just won't bite. It's just not in him. And that's how it is. And so Scotty Burrell has all kinds of testosterone, but is an unbelievably sweet person. And you can see it in the film. It's just how it is. And so you don't have to look too far to find examples like this. And but it's a great question, because, you know, obviously we are aware that testosterone levels are highly correlated here. There's no doubt about that. But they're definitely not the only, the end all be all of the story.
I think that you explaining that just made it clear to me why it's hard to find examples in other domains. It's because sports is probably the main domain where you can, where talent outranks the agreeableness factor, where disagreeableness is going to be important for success in almost every other domain.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly between men.
Mm-hmm.
So the dominance climbing requires a fair amount of disagreeableness just to get to the top. And so those are the examples we know. So when we're trying to think of, captains of industry across domains, they're pretty much all high testosterone disagreeable.
Right.
And it's difficult to kind of think of what that sort of stereotypical archetype would look like, but we can easily imagine it in the sports mm-hmm. world, the easygoing, but very talented basketball player. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's been a lot of those guys, that's a great example of where you can find this semi-anomaly. Yep. All good.
Well, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. Really appreciate this. And Dr. Hawk, hopefully it's not too cold. It's probably getting a little cold right now as we're finishing up this podcast. But
as long as it doesn't kill my potatoes, I'm fine.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan. Yeah. Well, we're out here in California, so I'm sure it's great down. Are you in down south right now?
Yep. Yeah, I'm in California right now.
Yeah, we're toughing it out, Jen. Life at 70.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's like
and the apocalypse is coming for you first. So, enjoy it while you can. I get advance notice out here.
That's right. That's it. All right. All right, guys. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Dr. Lyle. Thank you guys so much. We'll talk to you guys next show.
Very good. See you soon. Right.
Thanks for listening. Right. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.